Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Sentencing Guidelines Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 19, 2013, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Pew v. United States. The question in the case was whether a court violates the Constitution's prohibition on ex post facto laws by using the U.S. sentencing guidelines in effect at the time of a defendant's sentencing rather than those in effect at the time of the underlying offense, when the newer guidelines propose a higher applicable sentencing range and thereby expose the defendant to a longer recommended sentence. In an opinion delivered by Justice Sotomayor, the court held by a vote of 5-4 that the ex post facto clause precludes federal courts from using sentencing guidelines imposed after the defendant committed the underlying crime when newer guidelines propose a higher applicable sentencing range for the crime. Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, and Kagan joined the majority opinion in full, and Justice Kennedy joined the opinion in all except parts 3C. Justice Thomas filed a dissenting opinion, which was joined to Parts 1 and 2C by Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Scalia, and Justice Alito. Justice Alito also filed a dissenting opinion, which was joined by Justice Scalia. To discuss the case, we have Carissa Brin Hesek, who is a professor of law at the S.J. Quincy College of Law at the University of Utah. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Hesek.
Hi, my name's Carissa Hesek. I'm on the faculty at the University of Utah College of Law, and I'm going to talk to you today about Pew versus United States, which the U.S. Supreme Court decided on June 10th, 2013. So Pew considers whether the ex post facto clause is violated when a defendant is sentenced under federal sentencing guidelines, which were enacted after the defendant committed his crime, and when the new guideline suggests a higher sentencing range than the guideline that had been in effect when the crime was committed. In the Pew decision, the court decided that such a sentencing does violate the ex post facto clause. So Pew is interesting because it gives insight into two different issues facing the court. It shows us that there's some disagreement about the ex post facto jurisprudence. It also shows us some pretty significant disagreement over the status of sort of still evolving federal sentencing law. So to understand those issues, it's first necessary to give some background information about the ex post facto clause and those recent changes to federal sentencing law. So let's start with the ex post facto clause. The definitive case on the ex post facto clause is Calder versus Bull, which was decided in 1798. That opinion defines the scope of the ex post facto clause, and it makes clear that every law that changes the punishment and inflicts a greater punishment than the law annexed to a crime when committed will violate the ex post facto clause. So the question in Pew was whether a change to sentencing guidelines runs afoul of that rule from Calder versus Bull. Now, subsequent cases have refined the Calder analysis, with the Supreme Court explicitly acknowledging that the meaning of the ex post facto clause is the product of what they call the accretion of its own common law over a series of years. Recent cases, such as California Department of Corrections versus Morales, which was decided in 1995, have framed the test for whether a law impermissibly increases punishment above the level set at the time a crime was committed. They reframe that test as to whether the law, quote, produces a sufficient risk of increasing the measure of punishment attached to the covered crimes. In Garner versus Jones, which was decided in 2000, the court restated that test as whether the change in law, quote, creates a significant risk of prolonging the defendant's incarceration. So the Supreme Court had previously decided a case about the ex post facto clause and sentencing guidelines in 1987. That case, Miller versus Florida, involved a state sentencing guideline regime that pretty severely restricted the discretion of judges when imposing sentences. And the Supreme Court in Miller held that changes to the Florida sentencing guidelines triggered the ex post facto clause, and therefore defendants couldn't be sentenced under higher guidelines if they'd committed their crimes before those guidelines were enacted. And following the decision in Miller, every federal circuit held that retroactive application of amendments to the federal sentencing guidelines violated the ex post facto clause if they increased sentences above the sentence in place at the time the crime was committed. So, we had circuit court unanimity on the application of the ex post facto clause to the federal sentencing guidelines. But Pew represents two complications. First, Miller was decided under an old ex post facto clause test, namely whether the change in law put a defendant at, quote, a substantial disadvantage, And as I mentioned, the new test is whether the change in law creates a significant risk of prolonging the defendant's incarceration. That was the less complicating aspect of Pew. The larger difficulty facing the court in Pew were the recent changes to the federal sentencing guidelines, and one of the major questions that the court had to decide in Pew was whether those changes to the federal sentencing guidelines changed the federal sentencing guidelines enough so that the analysis in Miller would no longer apply. So how exactly has the federal sentencing system changed? Well, in 2005, the Supreme Court declared that the federal sentencing system was no longer going to be a mandatory sentencing system, and instead it was an advisory sentencing system. They did that in a case called Booker versus United States. So prior to Booker, judges had to calculate a defendant's sentence using a series of rules, the federal sentencing guidelines, and those rules would give them a very narrow range in which they could impose sentence on a defendant. Booker said, look, you still have to perform those calculations, but whether you want to sentence inside or outside of the guidelines is a matter really for the discretion of a district court judge. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me first explain why Booker got there. The decision in Booker came about because of a 2000 opinion in a case called Apprendi versus New Jersey. That case involved a legislative sentencing enhancement which increased the statutory maximum penalty available if the judge found a certain fact. The Apprendi court said those sorts of statutory sentence enhancements violate the Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial, because if there's going to be a fact that increases the statutory maximum penalty, then that fact has to be found by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. Relying on this principle from Apprendi, the Booker court explained that to the extent the federal guideline system allowed judges to make findings that resulted in sentencing ranges above those authorized only by the jury's verdict, those mandatory guidelines run afoul of the Sixth Amendment. So one obvious way to fix the constitutional problem identified in Booker would have been to impanel sentencing juries, right? To have juries that find sentencing facts that would adjust ranges under the guidelines. But that's not what ended up happening in the Booker opinion. Instead, Justice Ginsburg joined with the four justices who said that there was no Sixth Amendment problem to fashion a new remedy. In particular, they said that the guidelines were no longer going to be binding on district court judges, and since they're no longer mandatory, then they're not governed by the rule established in Apprendi. So you might be asking what the mandatory or advisory nature of a guideline sentencing system has to do with its status under the ex post facto clause. Well, the short answer is that there's sort of a textual argument, and the argument is that the Constitution forbids the enactment of ex post facto laws, and while mandatory guidelines have the force and effect of legislation, advisory guidelines do not. Now, to elaborate on that argument a little bit, those people who think that advisory guidelines don't trigger the ex post facto clause point out that while mandatory guidelines will have a definite effect on the length of a defendant's punishment, a change in advisory guidelines may very well not. So if a judge has to follow the guidelines, then changing the guidelines will necessarily change the punishment a defendant receives. But if a judge is free to disregard the guidelines, then changing the guidelines is no different than any other number of change circumstances that could potentially result in a longer sentence for the defendant. In other words, allowing advisory guidelines to trigger the ex post facto clause could result in a large expansion of the application of the clause. And that's essentially the argument that the government advanced in Pew. But the ex post facto clause issue is complicated by some unresolved issues in federal sentencing doctrine. As I mentioned before, the Booker opinion changed federal sentencing so that the federal sentencing guidelines are now advisory. But there's still significant disagreement, both among the circuits and among the justices themselves, about precisely how much sentencing freedom federal district courts have in the wake of Booker. In fact, the way I read them, the majority in dissenting opinions in Pew were essentially founded on just their different views about what effect the guidelines currently have on federal sentencing. So what is the sort of unresolved issue about federal sentencing doctrine? Well, the Booker opinion said that district courts were no longer obliged to impose guideline sentences, but the same opinion said that the courts were still required to calculate the guideline sentence and to consider that sentence as one of several factors in determining an ultimate sentence. And Booker also explicitly retained some appellate review features of the guideline system, though it decreased the level of appellate scrutiny. And the Booker remedial opinion, which was written by Justice Breyer, said that it expected appellate review would promote uniformity in sentencing. In other words, while the district courts were free to sentence outside the guidelines, the appellate courts would police that exercise of discretion. In its sentencing cases after Booker, the Supreme Court has walked what I think of as almost a tightrope between sentencing discretion on one hand at the trial level and fidelity to the guidelines imposed at the appellate level. So let me give you a couple of examples of what I mean. So one example, in a case called Rita, the court said that appellate courts can adopt a presumption on appeal in favor of guideline sentences. They can presume that guideline sentences are reasonable. That case and a subsequent case called Nelson emphasized that trial courts can't use that presumption. They can't assume that a guideline sentence is the correct sentence, even though that's the legal standard that will be used on appeal. Now, I've argued in my own scholarship elsewhere on post-Booker sentencing that this is a new and probably silly use of a legal presumption. And more importantly, though, it demonstrates that the Booker remedy is, on some level, frankly, sort of schizophrenic. The Supreme Court has imposed certain procedures like appellate review and requiring trial courts to begin their sentencing analysis with the calculation of the guidelines. These post-Booker procedures are obviously intended to ensure that most judges keep imposing sentences in the guidelines range. But because the Sixth Amendment remedy in Booker was designed to give judges the freedom to sentence outside of the guidelines range, the court's essentially trying to have its cake and eat it too. It's telling federal trial court judges that they're not bound by the guidelines, and so they don't have to worry about the Sixth Amendment issues from Apprendi. But at the same time, the court's creating structural sentencing features that are intended to push those very same judges back into the guidelines range. This schizophrenic approach to the guidelines and to judicial sentencing discretion can be found in a number of the court's post-Booker sentencing decisions. A single decision will contain statements that suggest broad district court discretion is appropriate, and then several sentences later include statements that suggest that discretion has to be limited and should be limited by the appellate courts. In Gall, for example, the court overturned a circuit court decision which reviewed decisions to sentence outside of the guidelines based on a proportionality principle. That is to say, they required a sentence that substantially varied from the guidelines to be, quote, justified by extraordinary circumstances. At the same time that the Supreme Court purported to reject this proportionality review, the court in Gall included the following statement that it's, quote, uncontroversial that a major departure should be supported by a more significant justification than a minor one. In other words, the court said it's uncontroversial that the persuasiveness of the explanation has to be in proportion to how large the variation is from the guidelines. The Gall court made no effort to resolve the tension between this statement, which encourages substantive appellate review of sentences outside the guideline range, and the court's holding, which suggested that appellate courts should defer to district courts. Now, in my opinion, these conflicting statements reflect not only a court trying to have its cake and eat it too, but they reflect a division on the court itself about what role the guidelines ought to play. Justice Breyer, in particular, appears to have championed the position that the guidelines ought to continue to play a major role in federal sentencing after Booker. Justice Breyer, as many of you probably know, was an original member of the U.S. Sentencing Commission. He's widely credited with being the author of the first federal sentencing guidelines, and he dissented from all of the court's Sixth Amendment sentencing cases, insisting that mandatory sentencing enhancements don't trigger a jury trial right. Justice Breyer joined the majority opinions in Rita and Gall and some other post-Booker sentencing cases, and I can't help but wonder whether the conflicting analysis in those cases was inserted at his insistence. As I mentioned, the parties in Pew offered conflicting characterizations about the role that the guidelines continue to play after Booker. The petitioner in Pew relied on the presumption of reasonableness and other features of post-Booker sentencing doctrine in support of his argument that, although the guidelines are no longer binding, they continue to have the force and effect of law, albeit in a more limited fashion. Pew also presented significant statistical data demonstrating how influential the guidelines generally and guideline amendments that increase sentences in particular continue to be after Booker. In contrast, the government portrayed the guidelines as playing only a minor role in post-Booker sentencing. The government stated that the guidelines are merely one source a judge might look at when imposing sentence, and stating that they have no more legal effect than a policy paper. This very limited role for the guidelines after Booker is in keeping with the views of some of the justices who spearheaded the so-called Sixth Amendment sentencing revolution, in particular Justices Scalia and Thomas. And ultimately, these divergent views about how much influence the guidelines continue to have after Booker appear to have separated the majority into sentencing justices in Pew. The majority, written by Justice Sotomayor, focused on the procedural features of post-Booker sentencing that push judges towards the guidelines. For example, the majority stated that these procedural requirements, quote, cabin the exercise of a sentencing court's discretion, and that the current system, quote, will steer district courts to more within-guideline sentences. And what's more, the majority rejected the Solicitor General's characterization of the guidelines as just one among many persuasive sources a sentencing court can consult, no different than a policy paper. In contrast, the dissent, which was written by Justice Thomas, presented a very different portrait of the guidelines' authority after Booker. The dissenting justices emphasized that the guidelines, quote, do not constrain the discretion of district courts, and that the guidelines, quote, do not create a high hurdle or any hurdle at all that must be cleared before discretion can be exercised. Put simply, it appears that Pew may have finally forced the court to grapple with the role of the guidelines after Booker. And this is certainly a positive feature of the case. Prior to Pew, all of the conflicting language in the court's opinions had led to a lack of uniformity in the circuits. Some circuits had seized on language that favored the guidelines, while others had seized on language that emphasized district court discretion. And as a result, the standard of appellate review for sentencing is currently not uniform across the country. Frankly, I think it'll be interesting to see whether the decision in Pew pushes some of the more discretion-friendly circuits towards more stringent guideline enforcement on appeal. Now, I know that I've spent a very long time talking to you about the sentencing law consequences of Pew, and I suppose that's the problem with asking a sentencing person about the case. But Pew should also be of interest to those of you who care about the ex post facto clause. As I mentioned in my post-argument pre-decision podcast on this case, Pew could have been an opportunity to cut back on the doctrine for when a change in law triggers the ex post facto clause. Indeed, the 2006 Seventh Circuit opinion that led to the circuit split underlying Pew, United States versus Demery, contained a critique of the significant risk test and essentially refused to apply it. And at oral argument, at least one justice indicated that he was not sympathetic to how broadly the significant risk test could be interpreted. That was Justice Scalia. But at the end of the day, the majority opinion applied the prevailing significant risk test to assess the ex post facto question. So then you might ask, so why would this case be interesting from an ex post facto perspective? Well, it's interesting because two justices indicated that they're not happy with the current state of the law surrounding the ex post facto clause. Justice Thomas indicated that he would abandon the significant risk test altogether. And Justice Sotomayor indicated that she thinks the purpose of the ex post facto clause is best described as preserving, quote, fundamental fairness, rather than simply notice. I read these opinions as an indication that the ex post facto jurisprudence may be open to change in the near future. Of course, these are only two justices out of nine, and Justice Thomas and Justice Sotomayor don't even agree on what should change in ex post facto jurisprudence. But both Justice Thomas and Justice Sotomayor made a point of publishing this analysis, even when it cost them votes for portions of their opinions. Justice Thomas couldn't get any of the other dissenting justices to sign on to his analysis to change the significant risk test, and Justice Sotomayor lost Justice Kennedy, and thus her majority, for the section of her opinion where she endorsed a fundamental fairness approach to ex post facto jurisprudence, as opposed to simply a notice-based analysis. In any event, the fact that both of the justices insisted on including this analysis may be an opening for an enterprising attorney looking to change the doctrine in this area. At least two justices seem to think that the current ex post facto clause doctrine ought to be revised, and perhaps the other justices, the rest of the plurality that joined that portion of Justice Sotomayor's opinion, may also feel strongly as well. So this is where I'm going to go ahead and end the discussion for today. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.